Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 311, I chat with video guru Florian Friedrich about calibrating HDR displays. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded July 7th, 2016. Episode 311, Calibrating HDR. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Florian Friedrich, a video consultant. I would call him a video guru, actually, working with a lot of different companies on high dynamic range video. Florian, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
So nice of you to be here, especially staying up so late as you are in Germany, no less. Now, you've been to the U.S. quite a few times this year. You've told me 6 times in the last 6 months. But yes. that's a lot of traveling, I got to tell you. But for the moment, you are back home in Germany. So thank you very much for staying up so late.
It's only 23 hours. So yeah, after a major football game that we have lost.
Oh, well, hopefully being on the show will cheer you up a little bit. So listen, those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv can log into the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv. And I'll be looking at that. And you can post questions for Florian as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps if you put my screen name in your comment or your question, which is my full name, Scott Wilkinson, all one word, no dots or dashes or spaces, because then it shows up in a different color on my screen, and my eye will be more naturally drawn to it. So, Florian, we're here to talk about high dynamic range, or HDR, which is a very exciting thing. I have said many times, and I'm sure you would agree, that it's far more important, really, to the growth and development of TV and video in general than adding extra pixels, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I absolutely agree. High dynamic range. I'm a big fan of high dynamic range, so it is really like it is much more important for me than any of the resolution improvements. So UHD together with HDR is a much better TV system, and mm-hmm. It's much easier to see the differences for people who are not used to evaluate video quality.
Right. So as I've said also, to see the increased pixel resolution of UHD or 4K, you need to be sitting pretty close to the TV. But with high dynamic range imagery, you can be clear across the room and you see it right away.
Yeah, one experience that we made in showing high dynamic range images is because of the specular highlights in the images can be very, very small and still be visible from a larger distance. The experience that we made is on a 65-inch UHD screen, you could see the difference even 7 meters away or so. So that's a huge difference to what is currently being communicated as a minimum distance for a UHD screen. So in fact, in order to see the full UHD resolution, you need to get close to the screen. I don't want to confuse that. But even if you're further away, you can see the effect of HDR.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to make sure everybody understands the terminology we use here. And so I might interrupt once in a while. Specular highlights are little tiny bits of very bright information. For example, the sun reflecting off of a lake or a metal thing or something like that. That's what we mean when we say specular highlights. It doesn't mean the entire screen is really bright. It just means a tiny little piece is. And that really looks much more realistic than what we see on TV with standard dynamic range, which we've been used to for a very long time.
Yeah, those specular highlights can be can occupy a big part of the screen or a small part of the screen.
But normally
they would occupy a small part of the screen. In many scenes that you see every day, you walk around in the nature, and then you see like grass reflecting the sun or leaves on a tree reflecting the sun, and all of that is very important for our impression of depth in the image. It is making the image much more realistic, and with SDR, we're currently taking away this kind of dynamic range and information.
Mm-hmm. Which, as we were talking about before the show actually started, in high dynamic range imagery, we were talking about 3D, you know, stereoscopic 3D. And with high dynamic range imagery, you get more depth naturally without having to wear those stupid glasses.
Yeah, and you know, doing HDR demos, many people say, wow, this is, I can't believe this is a 2D screen, because it's really a much better impression of picture depth than, you know, with only 2D SDR.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is all great, and I'm really happy to see it coming along, but it's so new, it's in its infancy, really, and there are still some issues with it. It's not really all that well-defined. Particularly calibration, which causes all sorts of issues. Can you summarize what some of those issues are?
Well,
I mean, that's what we're going to talk about during this whole show, but yeah. You know, to start with, yeah.
Okay. Let's start with the fact that HDR is a new system, and as all the new systems before, we see the problem that, you know, a new system needs to be adopted by multiple persons and companies, pieces of the production chain. Like, it starts that cameraman needs to learn how do I shoot dynamic, high dynamic range, because the lighting can be different than what they were used to light in SDR. The next thing is post-production. How do how would a post-production company adapt to HDR when it's a new technology that's not perfectly defined, where you don't know what the carrier will be? Is it going to be streaming? Is it going to be Blu-ray? What kind of possibilities do we have with this new format? All of this is very hard to understand in a short period of time. So as much as some of this is confusing right now, we've seen this with other technologies as well, like the transition from 601 to 709, from SD to HD. So it's a natural process of evolution.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, this is part and parcel of what it means to be in consumer electronics, right? I mean, things always progress technologically; they get better. And so, by the way, just for those who don't know, 601 and 709 are the color definitions of the color gamut or primaries of standard definition television versus high definition television. And now that we're going to ultra high definition television, we have yet another actually set of gamuts that we're talking about. And we're going to get into that during the show. But I think one thing that you told me when we were talking offline was that really, other than the camera, which we'll get into a little later, you've actually done some shooting in HDR to do some experiments with it. In the post-production world, we have to start with monitoring, right? I mean, what are they looking at when they're putting together the footage that was shot by the camera? And so the correct monitoring is one key element that needs some work, right?
Yes. We have to see that we have multiple new elements in HDR. One new element is the transfer function, meaning the translation from signal values into light values on the display. So this is completely new. This is now following the PQ standard, the PQ curve, which was defined in SMPTE 2084. Yep. And we can talk about this a little later. And one other part is a wider color gamut that could go up to Rec 2020, which is, a color gamut defines the primaries that a display would use in order to represent the colors in a signal, in a picture. So so these colors are now at up to single wavelength coordinates. So it's a really big color gamut, so to say. But it's also a container. So we don't, it's not our goal to actually achieve these single wavelength coordinates in our color gamut. It's more important that the BT2020 is a container that could, cover P3, which is the current standard for cinema for the motion picture industry in general, and it could also cover 709, which is our HD standard, and the way how to cover it is using metadata, and this metadata is transmitted over HDMI. So we've just got HDMI 2.0a. Actually, there's 2.0b on the rise. But with 2.0a, we now have a set of metadata that is defining the characteristics of our mastering environment. A post-production studio can use a P3 monitor, which is something that they use when they are producing a motion picture for theater releases, the theater projectors are essentially DCI P3. So essentially they have one mastering environment, and they put this metadata from the mastering environment into the video signal and convey it over HDMI. And that, in this ideal scenario, will allow the TV to reproduce the creative intent most accurately.
Mm-hmm. I should say that metadata is information, not it comes along with the video stream. It is embedded or added to the video data, but it's not, you don't see anything. It's just telling the receiving device, the monitor or the TV or the projector or whatever, this video was mastered at this much peak brightness and other pieces of information. Now, I wanted to ask you, you've developed a couple of tools to help post-production houses in particular to make sure that they are doing what they need to do in order to make this metadata work. And so I'd love for you to tell us about these tools that you yourself have developed.
Mm-hmm. With a team. So one of the tools is SEI Edit. I have an image of it.
Graphic number one.
Yes. Yes. So SEI Edit is a tool that would allow you to add metadata, HDR metadata, to a HEVC stream. And that, of course,
HEVC, by the way, is the compression standard used for ultra high definition video.
Thank you. It's not only used for ultra high definition video, but with ultra high definition video coming, becoming relevant, HEVC is the codec of choice, at least at this point of time. Mm-hmm. And the video codecs, the video encoders, were not prepared for HDR, and we've created a tool that, this SEI Edit tool, that would allow to add all the metadata that is relevant for HDR into any HEVC stream. It can be 10-bit, it can be 8-bit, and HDR, by the way, most likely is a 10-bit stream. So it's defined to be a 10-bit stream on Ultra HD Blu-ray, and in fact, it doesn't make a lot of sense to do 8-bit with HDR because have this bigger color gamut. We have a higher dynamic range. So in order to cover these elements, we have to have more than 8-bit, ideally even more than 10-bit, but that's at some point in future, I guess.
Yeah, 10-bit. 10-bit is what most of the TV, certainly all the TVs do now. I suppose there might be some professional monitors that can do 12 bits, but what would be the point since it ultimately has to end up in a package that can be delivered to the home and shown in 10 bits?
Yeah, so to put that in perspective, for 8-bit, we have like 256 values from 0 to 255 for each individual chroma channel.
That's for brightness. That's for brightness from darkest to brightest.
Exactly. So in the legal range, which is what we use for video, it's reduced to like 219 values. And you know, this is what we have in terms of values for 8-bit SDR, 219 values for RGB, and later on they get compressed. So when we are looking into HDR and all the things that we want to do there, we are using 10-bit words, and these 10-bit words have 1024 values, with the legal range of signals going from 64 to 940. So that's 800 something values, 876 or so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 10-bit is something that is important, and 10-bit is something that is now stored on a UHD Blu-ray. So actually, we have a benefit on UHD Blu-ray compared to the current Blu-ray system, even if we use SDR, because the current Blu-ray system didn't support a 10-bit, and now with Ultra HD Blu-ray, we have 10-bit even for SDR.
Right. And by the way, I should just mention that the number of bits that are used to represent the brightness range, the more bits, the more gradual if you have a gradual gradation, sorry for the double wording there.
Smooth gradation.
Smooth gradation, thank you. If you have a smooth gradation in color from darker to lighter, if you have fewer bits, that might start to look banded. You might start to see the steps, the individual steps from one value to the next. With more bits, you don't see that. It just looks like a very smooth gradation, which is why it's important to have more bits than less, especially when the range from darkest to brightest is greater than it used to be. Exactly. So that's the reason for that.
Okay, so SEI Edit was one tool. Mm-hmm. You know, this is used for injecting the metadata into a HEVC stream, and mm-hmm. the other tool is the AVTOP controller, which is something that works with this guy here, the Integral from HD Fury.
Oh yeah,
it is connecting to the Integral and adds metadata to any HDMI signal that is coming in. And that's actually something that would allow a post-production house to monitor HDR with a consumer TV, because the consumer TVs usually don't have a manual HDR mode and need to be triggered into the HDR mode with some sort of metadata.
Okay.
And the broadcast devices out there, you know, like the breakout boxes from Blackmagic, AJA, at least until most recently, didn't support the HDR info frame. So actually, post-production houses didn't have a chance to monitor HDR on a consumer TV. And of course, if you're producing HDR, it is very important that you have a preview, that you know what you're doing.
And I should say,
the same applies to calibration. So the AVTOP controller, by the way, was implemented into Kalman, Spectracle Kalman. So you could put it after a, you know, standard dynamic range video generator and add the HDR metadata to it in order to have test patterns that would allow you to measure HDR. Now,
Wait a second. Hang on. You said you could put it after. By the way, there was a picture. We'll show that again. Yes. A picture of the cowman screen with that. You just said that you could put this after a standard dynamic range pattern generator and get. You could certainly add HDR metadata to that, but would it actually turn the signal into a full HDR signal?
Yes. But with a restriction.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So it works for windows of different brightness. You know, like you have a 10 IRE window and a 20 IRE window and a 30 IRE window. In that case, it works. It doesn't work for test patterns. You like the Bluetooth pattern or so, because you need to know that all the levels in HDR are completely different. That means that a specific value, a specific digit in SDR is resulting in a completely different light output in HDR.
Mm.
So all the test patterns actually needed to be reinvented. It starts with the Plouch pattern. The SDR Plouch pattern doesn't work anymore. Even if you add the HDR metadata, you need different levels. So these things you cannot make work. But there are generators like, you know, the Quantum Data 780, or here is a Meridio 6G, and you know those generators are now made for HDR, but there's still a lot of legacy devices, and you know, when I started HDR and developing these tools, it was actually early 2015. So it's like more than a year ago when I started this process, and there was nothing. You know, there wasn't anything available. But I wanted to do HDR. I wanted to see HDR, and it was surprising that. Back then, in summer 2015, some of the devices supported HDR already. So you could add the metadata and see HDR even from your current SDR sources. Not to confuse that, it's not a real SDR. You just add the. It's not a real HDR.
The HDR, yeah.
Yes, it's not a real HDR. Because you're only adding the metadata to it. So a device like the HD Fury cannot change the video levels at all. It leaves them alone. But if you're trying to monitor, you know, what any signal that you create would do in HDR, then it makes a lot of sense to add the metadata.
Mm-hmm. We've got a few questions in the chat room now, so let's take a look at a couple of those. Mike Heiss, my good friend in the chat room, is asking, now that they've announced ITU BT2100, which I actually hadn't heard of before, which he says is more than just 80 better than BT2020, do you have any thoughts on PQ versus HLG? Now, as he says, this is getting very geeky. These are two different electro-optical transfer functions. You mentioned transfer functions earlier, which is how do you get an electrical signal or a data value to correspond to some amount of light coming off the screen. And these are two different ways to do it. PQ is the common one that most people are using these days. HLG was developed by Hybrid Log Gamma, was developed by BBC and NHK, and might have some value to it and might come up and be another one to consider.
Yeah, see, 2100 is actually a progress from the ITU. It builds upon 2020, you know, the 2020 standard. So a lot of what was in the 2020 standard is now part of or referenced in 2100. And the big news actually is exactly what you said. It includes HLG as an additional format, not only SMPTE 2084, it also includes the HLG. So HLG, actually, you know, Hybrid Log Gamma was something that was designed because broadcasters were concerned that the metadata could be lost. You know, when they're doing a production, it could happen that the metadata could get lost. And then people would see a strange situation where, you know, HDR looks very flat if you don't add the metadata and if you don't put the TV into the right mode. Looking flat means that there's not a lot of contrast. It looks desaturated. And so there was this big concern of you know, what do we do in such a situation? And HLG is a good approach, a good solution to it, because it combines the usual gamma that we are used of with a dynamic range extension that makes it more HDR. So HLG is another form of HDR, so to say. There are many other things in the 2100 document. Some of the things where I think maybe there will be a revised version at some point or another. You know, they are even defining the backlight levels, which, you know, it says like 5 nits or so would be the maximum backlight level. And I think it's a little bit too low because if you're working with a 5 nit backlight, then the chances are high that your HDR content will look too dim, which is actually something that was discussed by some reviewers, magazines, and others. But a good strategy for it is using a proper backlight.
You said a 5 nit backlight. You meant 500 maybe?
No,
five nits.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, HDR, we're generally talking about a peak brightness of 1,000 nits or 500 in the case of OLED or even more.
Exactly.
So I'm not quite sure what you mean by a 5 nit backlight.
Yeah, that's why I say I think maybe the 2100 standard needs a revision, because it's just my opinion. But you know, the 2100 document says, you know, the maximum backlight should be 5 nit, and I simply think it's too low, because if you're authoring content, if you're creating content with only 5 nits backlight, it's going to be a dim content.
Kidding. Well, you've just answered Undermine's question, which is, doesn't the move to define the HDR standards under BT2100 help alleviate some of the concerns we've been talking about? And it does, but it's probably going to need some revision.
Well, as you know, as said before, I mean, this is a process of evolving technology, and I'm actually impressed by the fact it's happening so fast. This transition from SDR to HDR, or coexistence maybe would be a better word, because I don't think that SDR would go away. And there are actually situations where SDR might be a better solution. For example, when you have some content that doesn't, you know, have a lot of dynamic range. So why would you use HDR in this case?
For example, all the content that's been generated up to this point, legacy content.
Exactly. So once you have clipped the highlights in an image, there is no way to restore it. I mean, yes, there are people who would like to be able to do that, but once something is clipped, it's the information is lost. So you can do some enhancement and make it better. But and it might look impressive. Like I could hear there are some lights, and I could try to make them, you know, brighter than T-shirt here, because probably they are brighter. But you know, this information is lost in the SDR picture. Once it is lost, it's hard to create it again.
Mm-hmm. getting back to the camera, man.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Muchacho asks, I would think there wouldn't be much difference for a cameraman shooting HDR. Can't the camera capture the content with a stop above and a stop below what he normally would?
Yes, I understand that. See, the problem is the lighting. So right now, when you're at a movie set, people try to have some uniform light. You know, to actually they're putting a lot of light into the scene, and they're trying to they're using fill lights, you know, to make some of the darker parts of the image not so dark. And this is the thing that can be changed, because when you're dealing with SDR, you actually have a situation where you cannot represent all the dynamic range that was in the original scene. So you have to do something about it. You have to use fill lights, and your lighting is completely different than what you would do for HDR. But to some extent, I would agree. I mean, you know, some cameras, you know, they have the ability to capture a lot of additional dynamic range, a lot of additional brightness, and you know, sometimes for some scenes it might just be okay to use the remaining data from the camera. We will see a lot of, and I'm actually happy, I'm looking forward to, we will see a lot of film. Film-based motion picture content in HDR, since film stocks had a lot more dynamic range than our current SDR. So I'm looking forward to see old movies in HDR, because HDR is very close to what and actually. When we look at it to its full extent, HDR is actually more capable of dynamic range and color gamut than film stock was. Even the best film stock, which was Kodak Vision 3. By the way,
we have a comparison of various dynamic ranges in graphic 5. So if we take a look at that, we can see and tell us what we're looking at here.
Yeah, so I have put that together essentially for my own learning process, what we see there is the dynamic range of different cameras and systems. So we can see that the early broadcast cameras, when SDR was on air the first time, the first broadcast cameras didn't even, you know, represent 100:1 contrast ratio. Now, with average positive slides, for example, we would exceed, you know, positive slides like you would use your 35 millimeter camera with a positive slide. You would exceed this 100:1 contrast ratio. And we're talking in f-stops. And a good film stock, the best film stock that was used in motion picture was the Kodak Vision 3, which is somewhere, you know, after the second yellow bar. We can see that Kodak Vision 3 is just in between 4,000 nit high dynamic range and 10,000 nit high dynamic range. And in fact, the color gamut of these analog film stocks is nearly identical to P3. So P3 coordinates are nearly identical to something that was defined as generic film. And this system now, for the first time ever, is capable of reproducing analog film stock to its full extent. And it's obviously a different look, you know, when something is digitized and compressed than what you see with a regular projection. But in a regular projection, on the other side, has some problems with like stray light, and so we're now in a position to exceed the experience that we, you know, that people would see decades ago with analog film stock in motion picture theaters. We're actually starting to exceed this with the current technology, or the technology of the next few years. So we might be able to see, and that's very fascinating, we might be able to see analog film better than you know, with analog projection in theaters.
Well, this gets into the whole question of, you know, film versus digital, both on the capture side and on the projection side. But it seems to me that digital is, in certain ways anyway, exceeding the capabilities now of film.
Yes. A good example, of course, is the Sony F65, which was on the chart there. So it was one of the, you know, one of the it's the second it's the second bar after the third I'm sorry for that the second bar after the third yellow bar. So this is not only exceeding the best analog film that was out there, it's also exceeding what's possible with HDR. And if we go into another 6B would be the 6B would be the picture, the slide number.
Okay. See if we can look at 6B.
Yep. If we go into that, we will see that we will be able to compare different color gamuts, and the F65 in this case is exceeding 20 to even 2020. So this is the second the second diagram that you could see on, the upper row second diagram. Sony is recording in this S-gamut 3, which is actually bigger than Rec 2020, and the dynamic range is bigger than HDR. So there are cameras, and you know, this over here would be the F65. I'm actually using it for demonstration materials that I'm shooting.
And we're gonna talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, go ahead, finish your thought, and then I have a little piece of business to do.
Piece of business. Okay. Now the major point is that we're exceeding what we were able to achieve with analog film. So digital is now starting to be accepted as a better version of motion picture production.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are certain filmmakers, I think Quentin Tarantino, a few others, who are still advocating for film and have forced the studios to pay a lot of money to keep one of Kodak's film production facilities open, probably the last one in the world. So the debate on that rages a bit, but I see what you see here is that in many ways digital is exceeding the capabilities of film.
Yeah. So one major point about HDR is when we are talking about, you know, BT2020 as a container, when we are talking about up to 10,000 nits, the interesting part about that is that we're talking about a container that is now ready for whatever there will be in future, like TVs with a bigger and bigger color gamut, TVs with a bigger and bigger brightness. So whatever we can think of in the next few years is already covered by this new system.
Which is really, really important, and a point that Joe Kane has made as well, that he wants the system to be as flexible and expandable as possible to accommodate improvements that we talked about earlier, technological improvements that are bound to come. There's no question about it.
Yeah, Joe Kane is a good topic here.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. You've been working with him, and yes, we will talk about together. That here. But before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, which is Epson. Now, Epson's revolutionary EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an innovative refillable ink tank, earning it the title of CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. The EcoTank ET4550 comes with enough ink to print up to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages, equivalent to about 50 ink cartridge sets. You're loaded and ready to print for up to 2 years. Powered by Epson's leading-edge precision core technology, it delivers high-speed, vivid colors, and laser-quality black text. Plus, auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value with ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles. Also, the Epson EcoTank system was named the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. With Epson's EcoTank line of printers, you'll have the freedom to print without running out of ink. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the Epson EcoTank printers. That's EPSON.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Epson, exceed your vision. So I'm talking with Florian Friedrich about HDR, one of my favorite topics because I find it so compelling. And we were talking about shooting with cameras and the Sony F65, which is certainly one of the high-end cameras that is now being used to shoot movies digitally. You have been using that camera actually to shoot some test material yourself, haven't you?
Yes. So multiple things are going on there. But maybe one of the most interesting things for people here, what we did, and I did that just recently last week with Ron Williams, one of your prior guests.
Yep.
We did put together a HDR still life. Okay. So and we actually
just graphic
have a picture
number
of
six.
It. Yes. So that's, you know, that's just an example. What we wanted to do is we wanted to have some natural colors like the bread that you would see there and the flowers and, you know, the wood, and also some colors that are going out of what we are used to see in 709. So for example, these LEDs, and there's this discussion about, do we need colors, you know, out of the 709 color gamut? And the answer is yes, LEDs are a big element of our lives now today. I mean, in our environments,
we have them everywhere.
Exactly. So it doesn't. It simply doesn't look natural if these LEDs are not shown. You know, if they are desaturated. And there is at number 11. There's a laptop. That's actually a prototype from Nanosys. You know, it's not a Nanosys laptop, but it was modified from Nanosys. And this is close to Rec 2020. So.
By the way, Nanosys is a company that makes quantum dots. I have the CEO of Nanosys scheduled to be on the podcast later this month.
Oh, very good. Very good. So the thing about this still life here is, you know, that we not only shot it with the F65, we also did some measurements of these individual spots with Minolta CS2000, which is a spectroradiometer, in order to see, you know, what kind of light differences and color differences and spectral differences we have there. And I actually think we have
that in 6A and 6B.
Yeah, so you know, these are just like you know, 30 is a filament of the lamp, you know, that you would see, and 7 is the green LED. You would see that the green LED's color coordinate is way outside the even the P3 color gamut, and in the scene, you know, we can go back to the scene. We would see brightness differences reaching from a more than 10,000 nit to less than 1 nit. And I can tell you, this is not something that is, way too bright lit up. It's just a regular room situation. These levels up to 10,000 nits, or let's say way above 1,000 nits, they happen in almost every room. So yes, a TV that would send 1,000 nits full wide, or let's say 10,000 nits full wide, to the viewer, would appear very bright. But that's not the topic. The topic is reproducing the specular highlights. Like if you look at 19, there's the vase below the flowers, and there's a reflection of the lamp, and if you take this reflection away, it is actually or if you reduce it, it doesn't look as realistic as it looks in real life. And that's one of my points why I think I'm a big fan of HDR, because of these specular highlights. And there was a discussion going on about, 10-bit SDR compared to 10-bit HDR.
Yeah, Joe Kane made that point when last time he was on the show.
Yes. So Joe Kane and I are working together. We not necessarily always have the same opinion, but we want to put our heads together and produce a program that, will help all interested home theater geeks.
Yes, very good. Excellent. Wonderful.
Will help all enthusiasts to understand the value of HDR and the value of SDR if done properly, as well as providing calibration tools or adjustment tools. So for calibration, there are some things that you can do currently, like adjusting the white balance and maybe adjusting some of the secondary colors of the color gamut when you do calibration. But obviously, it's not as advanced as it is for SDR, at least not at this point of time. But right. I'm sure we will see it getting better and better soon.
Now, the one of the things that you developed that I wanted to make sure we touched upon were some test patterns, because that's part of what calibration is. You need to have certain test patterns that have very well-defined characteristics in order to calibrate the TV to do what it needs to do. And we've got a ton of them in SDR, but we don't have very many of them in HDR yet. And you sent me a couple of examples, number 4 and number 9. And I just wanted to touch base on those a little bit and see what you had in mind there.
Sure. Okay, so this is an example of a test pattern in a post-production system, and of course it makes a lot of sense to run test patterns through a color grading and post-production system, even checking your encoders, because you would be surprised by the amount of options that can do can modify the values and. Unless you're running test patterns through the workflow, unless you have proper monitoring for HDR, you'll have a lot of surprises. And that's something that can be solved with test patterns. This pattern in particular is something that I developed, and many people in post-production studios found it, very useful. Even I did it. I presented it at seminars as well. It is a set of concentric circles where the center part of each circle is representing the highest brightness or highest saturation, depending on which circle you're looking at. And it also has an index for, what kind of IRE level you're looking at. So this is very helpful in order to see the clipping or the tone mapping. Both things are very important to analyze, and tone mapping is a quality factor for a TV and a whole HDR system. So this is one part. You know, you have to run test patterns through a workflow, and every piece of the chain, every piece of the signal chain needs to be analyzed. And especially when with a system that is so new and so unexplored and hard to understand at this point, you know, it makes a lot of sense to run mm-hmm. these test patterns.
We also have number 9. I just wanted to make sure we got that in real quick as well.
Okay. Yeah, this test pattern is something that is delivered with the AV Top Controller. So the AV Top Controller is the software that I've produced and that you can purchase for. I don't know if I can make the statements here.
Sure. Absolutely.
So it's a $99 piece of software, and it comes with this test pattern and also some scenes. We can take a look at the scenes later, but the test pattern will allow you to, you know, to see what kind of color gamut you're in. So you could put your meter into these patches and measure the color coordinates. And also you could see if there is a difference in between, let's say, the 1,000 nit patch and the 2,000 nit patch, or the 2,000 and 4,000 nit patch. Of course, when your TV is not capable of reproducing 4,000 nits, you will experience that it will be a different value. And that's the whole thing of tone mapping. I don't know if you'll have time to.
We do. We do. And I want to make sure we talk some about tone mapping, because it's really, really important. So this is a good entree into it. It seems to me that one of the one of the characteristics of PQ, the electro-optical transfer function we were talking about earlier, is that it's referenced to absolute luminance values. So 1,000 nits, 4,000 nits, up to 10,000 nits. Whereas gamma and HLG are not referenced to exactly specific values, luminance values. They're relative from the lowest to the highest, whatever the TV can do. And part of the problem with HDR is that different TVs have different characteristics, luminance characteristics. What is the brightest they can do? Some can do 1,000. Some can do less. OLEDs do more like 500. Professional monitors, professional broadcast and post-production monitors can go up to 4,000 nits with a Dolby monitor. So how do you deal with an HDR signal that may have been graded at one peak brightness level coming in and being displayed on a TV at a different, probably lower peak brightness level?
Yeah, good point. So actually, you know, I had a little smile on my face because some of the HDR TVs with OLED technology, when you put full white onto these TVs, like full field white, you'll see 150 nits, which is not much, which is not much more than, you know, we had in SDR. But yes, how do we deal with that? So let's say our mastering environment was 4,000 nits. So the monitor that was being used at post production was able to reproduce brightness levels up to 4,000 nits, and our TV can do 1,000 nits, which is what the better TVs do. Some can do 1,500 nits, and some can do a little bit less. But let's say the TV can do 1,000 nits. And now the question is, what do you do in this situation where PQ was supposed to be absolute and your TV cannot reproduce the signal levels going up to 4,000 nits? Mm-hmm. One example of what you could do is you could follow the PQ curve as long as possible, meaning that you could, let's say, follow the PQ curve up until 800 nits and then use the remaining 200 nits for representing the area that goes did go up to 4,000 nits on the mastering monitor. So, of course, you would compress the dynamic range of the picture, which would affect your specular highlights, which would affect, you know, the depth impression for the image, the realism But you want to represent it to a point where you are able to differentiate these highlights. And in order to do that, you need to apply tone mapping. Tone mapping in this case means that you're converting from one scope, from one dynamic range to another. And as said, in an ideal scenario, I would follow the PQ curve as long as possible and then spend the remaining part, like 200 nits, for representing everything that did go up to 4,000 nits. Now, we don't need to represent something above 4,000 nit when the mastering situation was that the monitor could do only a 4,000 nit because the post-production company couldn't see anything above 4,000 nit. So we don't care about anything that is above 4,000 nit up to 10,000 nit. So tone mapping is all about...
Not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet. Someday, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, we will see, sooner or later, we will see monitors that can do 10,000 nit. And I think there is one from JVC, like a rear projection system, that is restricted to only full HD, but it can do 10,000 nit. So yes, it is possible. And in this case, it would use the full amount of digits, the full amount of digital levels that are available in this 10-bit word. And that's maybe another good point to talk about. When you try to represent, so why do we need PQ? When you try to represent a dynamic range that is like 100 to 1 above your average signal level. Make it simple. All the content behind me would go to up to, let's say, 40 nits. Okay, and which is something that is realistic. And our there might be a spotlight that would go to 4,000 nits. We would have factor 100 in the signal, right? And 4,000 nit, by the way, for a light source is nothing that is too bright. That's a very realistic value. Mm-hmm. So we want to represent this 100 to 1 just above, you know, our main content in the picture. I've done the calculations actually just before the show. If we would use SDR for this 100 to 1 contrast ratio, we would lose 85% of the values, you know, just for representing this area between 40 nits and 4,000 nits. And that would mean that we would have only 15% of the values available for representing all these 0 to 40 nit contents.
Oh man!
And you know that is like 131 digits, you know, translated in a 10-bit word, which would be less than we had in 8-bit.
Yeah.
So for this kind of dynamic range representation, we cannot use the 1886 or, you know, let's say gamma 2.4, because it compresses. It would compress the dynamic range and it would add noise to the dark parts of the image, which is obviously something that we can see, something that is being realized by people who look at UHD Blu-rays. They see that, you know, somehow the dark parts of the image, they have less noise. And the reason for that is that we have more digits being spent at this, at these dark parts of the image. So the noise level is going down. I think that's, you know, that's something important. And now if you do this 100 to 1 situation with HDR, we only lose, which is still a lot, but we only lose 50%. You know, compare losing 85% to losing 50%. In a linear situation, like if we wouldn't have gamma at all, we would lose 99%, you know, factor 1 to 100. So unless we have like 16 bits or more available for HDR, we have to use PQ. The reason we need PQ is for a better quantization. The quantization is optimized for the just noticeable differences. And
just noticeable differences of what humans can see as steps in brightness.
Exactly. So as an example, if you have a 50 nit difference in the area from 25 nit to 75 nit, that's very visible because it is factor 3 actually. But if you have the same 50 nits difference in, you know, between 1,000 and 1,050 nits, that's just a tiny little difference. And PQ actually with, the Barton theory behind it and Dolby pushing it. So Dolby was kind of inventing PQ, is optimized for using, you know, a 10-bit or 8-bit, 10-bit, 12-bit word for a high dynamic range where you cannot use linear, because linear is, you know, you would need 16 bits or so.
Which is impractical with today's technology.
Yeah, because the data rates would be way too high and, the cables couldn't stand it.
They'd heat up and melt. let's see. You actually sent me a graphic of some tone mapping. I think this is what we're talking about here, 10A and 10B, which is the high dynamic range. So let's take a look at the 10A and 10B just as an illustration of what we're talking about here.
Okay. I think we need to make it a little bit smaller so we can see the tower as well.
Okay. Can we zoom out there a little bit? There you go.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Okay. So
this is in Berlin, by the way, right?
Yes. This is the Berlin Tower. We can zoom out a little more to show the whole picture. Okay. So this picture is like the original log captured image of the camera. And in this case, it was a Sony FS7, which is providing a very good dynamic range as well. But you can see specular highlights, the reflections, you know, from the tower are much brighter than the diffuse white of the building. Right next to it. You know, this is something that you can see right now. And now if you want to do, this looks flat. So this is not a representation of what it would be in HDR, and it's not a representation of what it would be in SDR. It's just showing the original image. Right.
And most of us are watching this on an SDR monitor, so that's part of the problem.
Yes. Now, if we would grade this for SDR, it probably would look like 10B, which we should move over to.
Okay. We will here in a sec. There it is. Whoa.
Okay. So, yes. So now you will see that this is some sort of appealing image with a lot of contrast in it. But you'll also see that, you know, the brightness difference in between the specular highlights from the tower and the building is not there anymore. So you're actually when you would measure, you know, the pixel values, it's the white center of the tower would be the same value than the building. So this is not how it looked like in reality, because in reality I looked at the building and I had some sort of a much brighter reflection that would hit my eye and would make it more realistic. So we're losing this in SDR. Now, tone mapping, of course, is a challenge, because we want to make sure that we don't lose a lot of dynamic range, but also we don't want to lose differentiation. So both things need to be maintained and need to be matched with a display that would probably only do a fraction of the maximum brightness that the mastering display would do.
So that calls for illustrates the importance of tone mapping, which relates back to metadata, because it's the metadata that allows the TV to do the tone mapping properly, right?
Exactly. Without the metadata, the TV doesn't know what the source was. The TV doesn't know the creative intention. The TV is not a person, obviously, but when you're using a container that can do a lot of things, you have to tell, you have to have some information that is actually that goes along with it and tells about the mastering condition. So without the mastering condition being transmitted with the signal, it is actually very hard to convey the creative message.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one last question here in the chat room from Muchacho, which is kind of interesting. What do you think about the brightness level on LG OLED TVs, OLED TVs in general, LG being the only company that makes them right now, except for Sony's broadcast monitor? How does it achieve brighter colors than in the gamut? And why is the brightness level so low? That's a limitation of the technology, right?
Mm, yeah. So when I look at HDR with very bright LCD TVs, which is actually what I prefer, because the high levels of brightness are capable of maintaining the dynamic range of the original image. I agree that OLED has a deeper black, but this deeper black is not necessarily right. And my problem that I personally have with the OLED technology to this point is that it is pretty much restricted to not delivering the full amount of color brightness, not the full color volume. So, for example, if you measure some of the OLED TVs, if you measure the color gamut at different IRE levels, you will see that the color gamut will change. And that's sometimes because of the structure of the subpixels, not the structure, but some have four subpixels, adding mm-hmm. a white subpixel to it. And this white subpixel, of course, cannot be red. So the white subpixel was added for getting more brightness. But now what do you do with a sunset? Like, a sunset is really bright, right? And mm. and I cannot say, well, I don't need the color anymore. And so there's a limitation. The red subpixel cannot be, because it's filtered, a filtered white one cannot be as bright as the white subpixel. And I see restrictions. In my personal opinion, it is a very interesting technology, but it's not quite there yet. Quite honestly, the perfect TV is not existing. I don't think that that there's any perfect TV. And even you would laugh about it, but even the professional broadcast monitors, which would cost about $30,000 or more, even they have restrictions. Maybe I'm a little bit too geeky about this.
Yeah, you might be, but so am I. And this is a show called Home Theater Geeks, after all, so we can get geeky. Right. I would say about the OLED black levels, yes, they're lower, certainly a lot lower than LCD, but that is only important, becomes more important when you're watching in a blacked out low ambient light condition. If you're exactly. watching like most people do in a higher ambient light condition, those black levels kind of don't matter, and you don't have the extra brightness at the top end to compete with the ambient light. So your arguments are well founded, I'd say.
Thank you.
Okay, well, one last thing. Go ahead. Yeah. You had something else to say?
No, I mean, it's just when you're working with the highest quality of images captured by a motion picture camera like the F-65, you're looking at what you've done. You're looking at what the original scene was all about, and of course, it's your desire that as much of it as possible will be recovered, will be shown by the TV. So when I see restrictions, I might be a little bit, overcritical. I just want to have a situation where as much as possible of the original image is represented.
Well, I want that too. I want the artistic intent to be maintained all the way from capture to display in the home. And this HDR certainly gets us a fair way towards it. And it's still a brand new thing and still working on it. As you said earlier, you and Joe Kane are working on a project called Quality TV. And I want to make sure to give that a plug. Because the two of you together, that's a potent force in the video world, I'd say.
Yeah, thank you. So Joe actually is visiting me shortly, and we'll be working together on a disc project with HDR test signals and, you know, a lot of surprises, I would say.
Good. Maybe you'll come back. Maybe you'll come back on the show with Joe, maybe, and the two of you together can talk about the developments since today.
Yeah, of course.
That'd be nice. Fantastic. Very good. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. And so for now, I want to thank you so much for being here.
I can't believe the 1 hour is over. Incredible.
Yeah, I know. Time really flies during this show. That's for sure. And thank you so much for staying up so late in Germany to be with us today. That was well above and beyond the call of duty. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
So that's Florian Friedrich. You can learn more about his work at website quality.tv. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com, and you can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/HTG and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Now, next week, I have not yet locked down a guest, so it's going to remain a mystery. But you can be sure it'll be somebody very interesting to talk about something in the world of audio-video geekery. And I do hope you will join me for it, because I'm sure looking forward to it. Until then, geek out.